Menders, Episode 9, Creating Space for Indigenous and Ethnic Minority Perspectives in Healthcare with Dr. Orlando Sanchez.
So the hummingbird says, well, I've been going down to the river, carrying what I can in my beak and dropping it on the flames. I don't know what else I can do, but that I can do, I don't know how much it can help, but that's how I can contribute. And so I try to be the hummingbird. I don't know how much I can contribute. I don't know how much I can help. What I can tell a system who is facing any kind of crisis, whether it's a fire or not, I'm here to help. I bring my attitude, my disposition. How can I assist?
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant, Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team? Sustain your momentum as a leader and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Welcome. Today we have Dr. Orlando Sanchez. And Orlando, you're a public sector neuropsychologist. You also were sharing with me that you're a professor, assistant and adjunct professor at three universities in both Washington State and Guatemala. And to give a little context, you and I have actually trained together. We were in the same doctoral program. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for you as a scholar, as a professor, as a fellow clinician, and as a fellow human. And I'm so delighted to have you with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation. And yes, we do go back a long way. So it's such a delight to be here and sharing this space with you. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. So I invited you here to share your unique perspective. You come from the Mixteco culture, and you're a neuropsychologist, and you've been working in healthcare for quite a few years in a variety of settings. So I'd love to have you just start by sharing a little bit about yourself and your unique cultural background.
Absolutely. So yes, so I'm indigenous. So I'm originally from southern Mexico. So I'm Mexican by nationality. But ethnically, I'm indigenous. In our language, the name for our indigenous band is Ñusabi. In Spanish, or in the dominant Mexican language, we are known as Mixtecos. And we're a pretty large indigenous group. And we are generally divided into three main large bands or groups. So the Mixtecos of the highlands, the Mixtecos of the lowlands, and the Mixtecos from the coast. And we share the same language, but depending on the proximity of the language, it can be intelligible in certain groups, and then the far ends, it may not be intelligible at all. And our language is really much more comparable to languages such as Vietnamese, so it's a tonal language, so not closely related to the Romance languages, Spanish, Italian, at all. So I was born in this village. In Mexico, it's slightly different. So here in the U.S., some, not all indigenous tribes, but some have federal recognition, so federal rights, so they have autonomous governments. In Mexico, it doesn't quite work in that way, reservation-like. We have some legal rights, but informally we are autonomous. So even though we may not have we're not a nation of our own, we do operate for all intents and purposes as a unique nation with indigenous values, and everything and anything is provided by the community. So, and this has been going on for, you know, since pre-Columbian times. So yeah, so that's where I come from. I came to the U.S. when I was around 9 or so. And yeah, I've been here, never lost connection to my community. That's always been very, very important to me, to not only maintain physical connection, but more importantly, philosophical values, beliefs, to really retain much of my cultural's philosophy of life and worldview, and combine it with philosophy of the West, teachings of the West, technology from the West. So it's not about one versus the other. It's an integration of both.
Would you just share a little bit more about how your cultural values impact your current work as a neuropsychologist in a Western healthcare system?
Definitely. So healing. So I come from a long tradition of healing. So so had I remained in my village, I likely would have been mentored under to eventually become a healer. So the idea that I would eventually become a healer was always in the making. By coming to the United States, the question was, will I return to my village and become a healer? Will I, the question was always, how is that going to work? So after I graduated high school, I actually retreated back to the village for contemplation, reflection, meditation within my community in terms of what's the next step in terms of how I will contribute to the village. And so the idea was that I was going to pursue higher education. What within Western higher education? That was the question. And so psychology, from what I understood back then, seemed to fit much more closely with our indigenous perspective of healing and illness, to try to understand humans and how to improve.
Hey, if you're listening to this and you're not sure how to get started to address burnout and create a culture of well-being in your organization, and you're looking for a roadmap and someone to support your team through this process, listen up, because this is for you. Investing in your people is the smartest thing your healthcare system can do. Whether you have a tiny system or a large complex department, there are focused actions you can take to transform your organizational culture from burnout to well-being. I work with leadership teams to simplify and demystify this process so that you can feel really good about the efforts you're putting out in the world, and so confident that your investments in employee engagement and team well-being will pay dividends. Head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com and join me today.
So in the village, there's different kinds of healers. So there's healers who are the equivalent of more orthopedic, or healers of the spirit and the mind. And so so that was the idea, is that I would be in the West learning how to be a healer of the spirit and the mind. So with that in mind, I returned to the United States, started my journey towards higher education to become a psychologist. And so that was clear from the get-go. I wanted to become a psychologist to learn from the West, learn. At that time, my fantasy was that we were so advanced that I was going to get all this knowledge, all the answers, all the questions were answered. So I was going to acquire all this knowledge and boom, here it is. But what I learned throughout the process is I had many, many questions that Western psychology wasn't able to provide the answer. So I wanted to know, well, how does this apply to me? How does it apply to my community? How can I use this with folks, not just indigenous communities, my indigenous community, but indigenous communities of Latin America, of Mexico, of North America, of around the world? And it was always very frustrating, because in fact, it was so frustrating that at one point I almost left the field, because I thought, this isn't what I thought, and it's not going to provide, it's not going to be very helpful. to my aspirations, to my goals. But it was during my second year of graduate school that I met a mentor of mine, Ted Judd, who is a cross-cultural neuropsychologist, bilingual, Spanish-English. And as I was getting ready to transition out, decided to meet with him, went to work with him, and shared what I just shared with you, and said, well, I can help you with that. So he had been working with indigenous communities from Central and South America for 30 years. And so I stuck around. He is a neuropsychologist, so I just learned how to be him. And so that's why I stayed within the field and why I eventually became a neuropsychologist myself.
Wow. Well, I think we're all grateful to Ted Judd. And he, I worked with him very briefly and I really appreciated that opportunity, but I'm just so delighted that he's actually such a contributor to your career. But I'm curious, how did work with him, a white mentor, how did that impact your cultural identity or your ability to really like bring in your own core indigenous values as a psychologist in training and as a psychologist?
Great question. Great question. And we could spend many minutes, hours. So in a nutshell, it is a very philosophical, it's a very deeply personal journey. So as an indigenous, you are bombarded with a society that, what is associated? Poverty. There's ignorance. In Mexico, it's not uncommon for somebody to use the indio as synonymous with ignorance or lack of manners. So there's this, you look at the media portrays, it really devalues or diminishes your community. And so you're bombarded with, it's really within your community that you have that sense of, it's your safe haven. That's where you breathe and feel free. Outside of that, it's this constant bombardment of negativity. And so I think that was the first challenge, was to learn how to navigate that, because there was a lot of shame. There was a lot of stress around that. And so to meet this man, this white man who could, I mean, he is 6-something, put one of those horn hats on him and his shield, and he's a Viking. He's, you know, he's blonde, blue eyed. And that was, my work with him was just so, it went beyond neuropsychology. I learned so much. For example, I learned that multicultural clinical skills aren't synonymous with your ethnic background. So as an ethnic minority, that automatically does not make me culturally competent. Cultural competency is a skill. And it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from. You can learn this skill. You can learn how to connect with folks from different cultures. It's something that we can harness. It's something that we can describe, and we can teach it, and we can pass it along. And so, through the mentorship with him, I became very. He taught me how to be. And there's no word for it. So there's, for example, biculturalism. So biculturalism is being able to exist in two cultures, your host culture and your home culture, and take the best of both worlds. But there's many subcultures. So there's the culture of academia. There's the culture, there's cultures within cultures. And so he really taught me how to be myself, learn how to be, explore who I am and be comfortable with who I am and feel competent about who I am, my skills, and learn how to navigate these subcultures. So as I mentioned, I was getting ready to leave the program. And so it's through his teachings that I got a sense of, okay, this is the culture of academia. These are the expectations. These are the rules of engagement. And I've just been playing the wrong game here. So he organized that for me. And once I understood that, I learned how to navigate that. I thought, oh, okay, well, this makes sense. Here's how I can contribute and learn how to engage and contribute to the system. And at the same time, take what I need to continue on in my journey. So very powerful. But again, I don't know if I answered your question. Sorry.
No, I think you really did. I mean, I was just trying to get at like that balance. Like, how do you stay or grow into who you are, your own cultural background, and be empowered in that working in a white system? And, you know, I do a lot of training. So relationships between supervisors and trainees is something I really care about. And, you know, navigating that relationship when people come from really different backgrounds is also something really interesting to me. You know, just being aware of my own blind spots as a white person, you know, and wanting my trainees or, you know, people working in my healthcare system, whatever their role is, to be really empowered, to be themselves, not to be me, or not to, like, you know, fake being white or something like that to pass in the system. So that's just sort of what I was thinking about, like, what helped you to navigate that throughout your career?
Yeah, no, and I think I cued into something you said, and that's, so you mentioned how within the training context, that supervisor-supervisee, that mentor-mentee relationship is very important. And you mentioned that you do your best to be mindful of, and you said that the word white privilege, right, of and blind spots. And it's through my work with Dr. Judd that I realized that, and thankfully since then, I've had the opportunity to work with folks outside of the United States. And in any context where there's a dominant group of individuals, and dominant, you know, it could be defined by any element, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be dominant based on numbers. So you could be small in numbers, but still be dominant by virtue of your gender, by virtue of your race and ethnicity, by virtue of your status, either temporarily able-bodied or disabled. So there's these all these elements, but what I've noticed is that in any environment where there has been a dominant group, they set the stage for what is normal, what is abnormal. And so there's this concept referred to as cultural encapsulation. So this goes back to the 60s. Where this counseling psychologist, C.G. Wren, developed that concept of cultural encapsulation. What does that mean? Well, culturally encapsulated individuals are individuals who operate within a worldview that sets the standard for everything else. So for supervisors, dominant culture supervisors, when they interact, they interact from within the rules of engagement of their perspective, and they project that outward. So as an ethnic minority, Dr. Judd, that was the first time where he had a sense of himself. So he had a sense of that worldview, his bubble. He was interested in getting to know mine. And then once he was able to ethically, socially responsible, competently navigate that to go into my worldview, and from within my worldview, teach me and educate me and help me understand. So it wasn't his worldview being imposed on me. It wasn't, I'm going to set aside my worldview and just cater to yours. No, it's a combination of, I can use my knowledge, my experience, my skill, bring you forth the right word isn't teach you, it's mainly make you aware and give room, give space for the things that I value, and teach me in the process. And so that philosophy stayed with me, and I took that wherever I went. Now, when you are in a position of authority and power, you don't need to relinquish, that's why you're in a position of authority and power. But it really helps when somebody in a position of authority and power has that awareness, and it's very inviting to come in and say, "Gosh, I'm seen." It makes for a great partnership, I believe, in any encounter, whether it's a mentor-mentee, employee, employer, whatever the case. But anyways, just some things that came up as I was hearing you.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. So I am curious, actually, on that note, I know you do a lot of teaching. I imagine you do a lot of supervision and training. Would you share a little bit about how, like, your own history of learning how to do that, just that beautiful kind of, I can't remember the word you used for it, but like the coming into someone else's worldview and teaching from within, how has that influenced you as a trainer, teacher, and supervisor?
Yeah, so great question. And so even before I came to the United States, that's an emphasis. That's something that my indigenous community values. Is there's different names for it. Toltecayot. It translates as the art of living with wisdom. So, you know, things like tonal, nahual. And so the idea is that you first need to have a full understanding of who you are, yourself. And so that aligned very well with what Dr. Judd was teaching me in terms of learning how to do that. We need to first appreciate the other's worldview. And so I apply that to all my work. Frankly, I apply that to every relationship that I engage in. I don't come in assuming, because a component of that is to be mindful of someone else's worldview in a non-judgmental sort of way. So it's not a, is mine better than yours, or that's incorrect, or it's merely, what is your worldview? And of course, the more elements that we share, so if we come from the same geographical location, if we speak the same language, if we have the same socioeconomic status, if we are of the same gender, if we're both able-bodied, et cetera, the more that we tend to view the world in the same fashion, including health, illness, and recovery, and things like that. But it's not always the case. So if I'm working with a trainee, first, I disclose that about myself, so I share who I am, my identity, not just my professional identity, but my identity. And the reason why I do that is because it impacts. For example, I have no real good concept of time. So I could sit here and chat with you because it's in the here and now. Where I come from, what we value is the here and now. What we value is things begin when they begin. Things end when they naturally have an end. But it's something that I've learned, and one has to learn how to be functional to exist in the 21st century in a very high-paced, highly task-oriented culture. You have to. So I've learned how to do that, but left to my own devices, I will just have a conversation with you endlessly until we both get tired and say, okay, great. That's great that we've had this conversation. We should do it again sometime. And this is another cultural element that you're seeing here. I tend to speak in a roundabout sort of way, whereas English is much more linear. Ask a question, I stay on point, answer, move on. And so I bring all these elements to, let's say, supervision, to cue my trainee that what you might be experiencing, and it might get in the way. So it's okay for you to tell me, let's be much more direct. Let's be much more focused. Let's be mindful of when supervision begins and when it ends. In fact, can you give me 10 minutes so that I can transition because I have something else at such time? So it's all about being mindful of your worldview and how you, there are folks for time orientation, for example, around the country, there are those who, what is that saying? If you're 15 minutes or 30 minutes early, you're 30 minutes or 15 minutes late. So these kinds of things really impact how we interact with each other and the assumptions that we might make about one another. I think it's important to whatever degree possible to have a conversation to calibrate. It just makes for a better relationship, I think.
I appreciate that. And have you had the opportunity or the privilege to work with other Indigenous trainees? Has that been something you've been able to do?
Work with other Indigenous trainees. So yes, I keep an eye out for ethnic minority trainees. I think when you look at the history of higher education, no doubt we've, particularly since the 60s, right following the trajectory of the civil rights movement. So the civil rights movement really had a profound impact in education and training, at least in psychology. And so with that, shortly after, so in 1982, the early 80s, For example, in education and training, there was Dr. Daryl Sue, who put forth his guidelines on multicultural education and training. And that eventually what that led to is that folks in our field started paying attention. And one of the initiatives was to improve the number of ethnic minority trainees coming into the field. And since then, it's slowly increased. For example, currently we have more ethnic minority trainees now in psychology than ever before. The task now is how to retain them, because environments aren't, yes, we've done a really good job of advertising and bringing in folks in, but how to retain them? I just shared that I almost left, and I'm not an isolated case. You see this in the literature. You see this just anecdotally, just chatting with folks. It's not the best environment. So knowing that myself, I do my best to keep an eye out for ethnic minority trainees and see if I can pass the wisdom and knowledge that Dr. Judd passed on to me, and see if I can do something to help as they continue in their journey towards higher education. By virtue of my background in being indigenous, yes, I'm particularly, but I haven't came across, that's the unfortunate piece, is that I haven't came across many. So there's not many of us indigenous folks in psychology, perhaps in other areas, but I don't have access to those other fields. But within psychology, I'm always mindful. And it's not just me. So there's folks, for example, in neuropsychology, there's a neuropsychologist coming out of Fordham University who is trying to put together indigenous folks from all across the United States and abroad to come together as neuropsychologists and form a network to support each other. But we are very, very small. So all this to say is, unfortunately, I haven't came across many, but if I do, because I'm aware of the challenges, I do what I can. I feel equally honored to work with. So my most recent trainee was a trainee originally from China, and so I did a lot of work in helping her how to become acquainted with the culture of academia and the culture of different training settings and how to navigate one's tendency. For example, in certain parts of the world, the rule of engagement is to listen. It's not the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, it's the squeaky wheel that gets pounded. And so when you're not aware of that, it can be stressful. It can lead others to make misperceptions about your behavior. They're too shy. They're not assertive enough, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's learning how to navigate that.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. And I have one trainee who I can think of in particular who was an ethnic minority, and I think did a really, really beautiful job of trying to give feedback when certain things happened and there was cultural stereotyping in some of her training experiences. And I was saddened and kind of dumbstruck by the unwillingness of the system to listen to that feedback. And like the response was really to characterize her in that way. Oh, like you're being, you know, this angry Asian or, you know, this stereotype. And there was just a total unwillingness to appreciate and hear the human and that real feedback. So that experience has stuck with me. But what do you think that healthcare organizations could do differently to change that, to create more space for those ethnic minority perspectives and to move away from that stereotyping?
That's a great question. It's a great, 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 complicated, complex question. And it's one that I've been thinking about for a really, really long time. And the short answer is, I don't know. But here's how I've been thinking about it. And forgive me, I'm going to give you the indigenous roundabout story, but I will eventually get to my point. So
I love it.
I've looked at this particular issue from a perspective of history and science in terms of what we know. So from a historical perspective, what we see in the United States, it's not all that unique. When you go around the world, the history of the world is really who conquered who. So who set the rules of engagement for that particular geographic location? And you can find what I call racial models all around the world. And what do I mean by racial models? Well, in these encounters, there were the conquerors who set the stage, and then there were the conquered who were less than desirable. What do we do with these undesirable individuals? So, for example, you have apartheid in South Africa. You have the terrible final solution of Nazi Germany and the extermination of the Jewish people. You have Jim Crow here in the United States. In Latin America, you have mestizo. Mestizo, most people will understand that to mean a word that means a mixture of Spaniard with indigenous blood. And that's true. But mestizo is also a racial model designed to deal with, well, what do we do with the indigenous population? What do we do with the Afro-Latinos? What do we do with the Asian Latinos? And so on and so on. So where I'm going with this is that these systems, all of it, economic systems, educational systems, healthcare systems, began as something. Now, of course, as we evolved as humans, we no longer have these terrible racial models, but systems didn't entirely, they took on a life of their own. And we really don't have to look very far. So you look at COVID-19, the COVID-19 crisis, and when we look at what did it have to take to contain that pandemic? Well, it took action at multiple levels and within multiple systems. And even then, it wasn't entirely perfect, but it took that amount of coordination and collaboration and cooperation to be able to change our behavior in terms of things like wearing a mask. And it took some time. And frankly, you know, so what would it take? At the very least, I think it would help if healthcare systems, individuals in healthcare systems, adopted a cultural competency. And what do I mean by cultural competency? There's elements in that. So what is believed in the literature that is the gateway to cultural competency is cultural awareness. An awareness of yourself, an awareness of your worldview, the awareness of how you view the world and how you engage with those around you. And so if you have folks in a healthcare system that can do that, that can harness that awareness, and then learn how to harness cultural sensitivity or sensitivity, which is now I have an understanding of myself, let me have this understanding of this person, and then work together. Now, of course, because it's a very deeply intra-individual process, and it's a developmental process, it takes for, I believe that an optimal solution is when both are at the same, because if you don't, then it's like if you spoke English and I spoke, I don't know, a different language, it would be very hard for us to communicate. And let's say that as we both strive towards awareness, then it becomes like you speaking Spanish and me Portuguese, or you speaking Spanish and me Italian, where we can kind of make sense of ourselves. But hopefully the idea is to move towards a mutual understanding. It's easier said than done. But I think that in my personal experience, that has helped. So whenever I've gone to different systems, I'm always on the lookout for individuals in positions of leadership and authority. And I come into that space with that mentality. I'm here to collaborate, cooperate. I'm not naive to the ideals that, look, no system will ever be perfect. We all have to compromise. If we want to work together, if we want to live together, we have to compromise. And there's common denominators. So we all worry about health. We all are mindful of doing the best we can to help individuals. So how can I help you in that mission? How do I bring the skills? Here's my skill set. Here are the parameters of what I can and cannot do, because I have a good sense of what those are. I'm very mindful, and I want to hear where you are. And then I want, if you are open to it, here's how I can work with you. And hopefully we are both reasonable and respectful and professional, that we can mutually walk in that direction. And if when it doesn't work, then respectfully, it doesn't work and I find a new environment. For me, mm-hmm. my work environment is the same as my home environment. It's where I spent most of my life. Most of my life is spent at work, at least 8 hours of my day, if not more. So that's a long time. So I treat it as my house. And I treat folks within my house as partners in the journey towards creating something in collaboration, in harmony, together. So, you know, if most of us thought in that manner, that'd be great. But beyond that, I don't know. So that's for me, that's what has helped. Is in any system, I always lock in, where is the chain of command? Who is in charge? I approach with this attitude, this demeanor. I try to be transparent. And when folks are reciprocal, it makes for a great partnership. It makes for an honest and genuine understanding of what can be done, what is realistic, and what is ideal, and we can work towards it, but we're not going to solve it over lunch or in a year. But I think it's having those, at least for me, that's been successful.
It's pretty incredible to me that you've been willing to put yourself out there so consistently and reach out to create those collaborative relationships and bring your full self into every organization.
Yes. And that goes back to Indigenous philosophy. So Indigenous philosophy is about that. It's about, we understand that there's reservoirs of knowledge and the idea is to seek partnership. The reason why my Indigenous village has been resilient for so many centuries is because we work in partnership with other Indigenous villages. We are constantly fighting with our neighbors that are a stone throw away. But as much as we fight, we realize that the future is partnership. So we have traditional practices where every year, each village is hosted, and so each village brings to this village something from their community, whether it's something monetary or manpower service of some kind, but it's a way to give to that community so that they sustain themselves for that year. And then it shifts. Next time it's this community. And again, we all bring forth and we all try to outdo each other in terms of how much we give, because it really is, it really does, like that saying says, it takes a village. So, I bring that. The values within my culture are collaboration, cooperation, reciprocity, respect, wisdom, living with the art of wisdom. And so I just try to live by those principles.
Wow. That's really beautiful. I'm just really touched by that. I really appreciate that. And it really speaks to the interdependence and how we really can't, I think, solve any of the problems that we're having, or, you know, in our healthcare system, in our Western worldview overall, unless we have those partnerships with people who feel and see and experience the world differently and bring different gifts in that really beautiful and generous way.
Yeah, and I think it's perspectives. I think at one point, as I shared with you earlier, I came in with the naive expectation that all the questions had been answered. And when you come from that perspective, it's easy to become frustrated and angry in terms of, here's the problem, why don't you fix it? Mm-hmm. I can't fix it. I don't have the skills, or I'm not in that position. So it's easy to become angry and demand. But sometimes the questions or sometimes the problem is so complex that we have a stake in it. And this reminds me of Diné Navajo Indigenous. So this was a gathering. This was up in Bellingham. I had the good fortune of being hosted by the Lummi Nation. And there were several Indigenous folks and a Diné Indigenous. As we were having this kind of conversation, shared a story from within his culture in terms of this philosophy. And so he shared that in this forest, now I'm not going to do justice to how he shared the story, but I'm going to do my best. And it stuck with me, so I'm going to... So he said, in the forest, you have these animals, ancestors, brothers, sisters, so bear, wolf, eagle. And this fire broke out. And as this fire is consuming the forest and raging on, all the animals become distressed. What are we going to do? Bear is suggesting this. Eagle is suggesting that. There is panic, and the fire just keeps raging. And who has the power to contain this massive catastrophe? And as they're doing this, as they're in distress, trying to figure out how to deal with this problem, the hummingbird keeps coming back and forth. So the animals finally say, look, are you going to be a part of the solution, or are you part of the problem? What's going on here? And they say, what are you doing? And so the hummingbird says, well, I've been going down to the river, carrying what I can in my beak and dropping it in on the flames. I don't know what else I can do, but that I can do, I don't know how much it can help, but that's how I can contribute. And so I try to be the hummingbird. I don't know how much I can contribute. I don't know how much I can help. What I can tell a system who is facing any kind of crisis, whether it's a fire or not, I'm here to help. I bring my attitude, my disposition. How can I assist?
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's quite something. So my last question for you is just what keeps you connected with your values and sustainable and, you know, able to find joy in what you do every day?
Yeah, another great question. And this is where I go back to my Indigenous values. So the Indigenous way is about harmony. It's about kinkunse. And so if you look at yourself from your navel to the sky is Quetzal. From your navel to the ground is Coatl, Quetzalcoatl. From your navel to the left is Nahual. From your navel to the right is Tonal, Nahual and Tonal. Quetzal and Coatl. And all of these combined give rise to kinkunse. So what this means is a harmony of your physical self, your spiritual self, your psychological self. How that translates is really what we know in healthcare that works. Eat healthy to the degree that you can. Sleep well. Do some kind of physical activity. Engage your body in something meaningful. Spiritual and psychological. Spend time with the people who you enjoy and who can give you that sense of purpose in your life. If there's a text that you consume that you find comfort in, a text of spirituality or wisdom, do that. And so it's not neglecting any of these elements. That's what sustains you. It's the principle of put your mask on first before you help somebody else. And so I, again, live by those principles. So I try to get some exercise. I try to not compromise sleep. I stay connected to my family and community. And that's the beauty, is that when I have folks around me, whenever I'm veering off in one way or the other, they say, you know, and so they bring me right back. And that's what sustains me in the long haul. Yeah, and I try not to do more than what I can.
That art and wisdom of living. Well, thank you so much. I'm so privileged and just so delighted to be able to catch up with you and hear your thoughts today. Thank you for being willing to share.
Likewise. So grateful to have shared this space with you to catch up. It's been a long time. So yeah, I hope we get a chance to continue to share, whether it's this space or any other space, just to, stay connected.
That would be delightful. Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.